Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. I'm your host, Jason Greenblatt. With tensions rising across the world, diplomacy is needed perhaps now more than ever. During my time as former White House Middle East envoy and as one of the chief architects of peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors, I've had the chance to witness the power of diplomacy firsthand, and today I would like to share that perspective with you. Shalom, salam, and welcome to The Diplomat. Hi, this is Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. Today, we have as our guest Mohammed Aliyaya. Mohammed is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow at the Harvard Belfer Center. We discuss today's Saudi Arabia and Iran and lots more. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hope you find it fascinating. Again, I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. Mohammed Aliyaya, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it. Welcome to The Diplomat.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with The Economist. The Economist recently had a cover art photo and an Instagram post of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. It was his back with a shamag, the Arab traditional headdress, and attached to the ogal, to the black braid around the traditional headdress, was a fuse. My take on it: disgusting. You know, what are they trying to say? The headline, by the way, was "Meet Mohammed bin Salman, the millennial autocrat who controls our oil." What do you think their message was? I think the post was taken down, if I'm not mistaken, maybe because of your efforts. I'm not sure. What's that about?
I don't know if it's because of my efforts. I doubt it. But I mean, you're absolutely correct, and you should be outraged. I think everyone should be outraged at that artwork that was used with the article. It was racist, and it you know, that type of racism belongs in a bygone era. Now, that shouldn't distract from the fact that the article itself was a deeply racist article that was based on hearsay, that refused to give Saudi Arabia credit for the many reforms that have happened in the country. But that's something, as you mentioned, that is a theme in coverage of Saudi Arabia. And this has been happening, you know, since the 1940s and the 1950s. Saudi Arabia is a deeply misunderstood place in the Western press. You know, a lot of friends who I speak to abroad who have a very negative view of Saudi Arabia, you know, I can't really blame them, because if your exposure to Saudi Arabia is all of these articles that in many cases are racist, and in almost all cases are deeply unfair, you know, what other idea of Saudi Arabia would you have? And almost as a rule, anybody who does visit Saudi Arabia realizes that the place that they went to is a totally different place than what's described in the mainstream media that you see in Europe, but also the United States, more so in the United States.
So I have that same experience. You know, I wasn't at all familiar with Saudi Arabia before 2017 when I joined the White House. How I was familiar with it was related to press that I read, almost entirely negative. Now I consider it a home the way I do all countries in the Middle East that I was privileged to visit and work with and know the leadership of. But I still face it when I do my interviews, and much like Israel, by the way, the press seems to be very negative on Saudi Arabia, negative on Israel, sometimes for similar reasons when they fight terrorists, in other cases for other reasons. It seems to be dismissive of Saudi Arabia. And I'm trying to figure out, at least with respect to Saudi Arabia, because that's the topic you can speak to, why do you think that is? Is it just an inherent bias that can't seem to be to disappear? Are people close-minded? What's going on?
And that's a good question. I think, you know, this can be the topic of a very long discussion. But I think one element that does exist is, you know, and this is more prevalent, I think, among people on the left. People who harbor, you know, negative views on Islam, or even Islamophobia, find that using Saudi Arabia as a punching bag allows them to do that in a way that is politically correct. And also, you know, politics are at play. People on the left tend to resent Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not an anti-imperialist power like Iran or Bashar al-Assad's regime. Among a lot of people on the left, you know, the idea that posture that these regimes take is something that resonates with them ideologically. Saudi Arabia has been a proud partner of the United States, has benefited immensely from its partnership with the United States, and has acted as a pillar for America's regional security order. You know, all of these things together really put Saudi Arabia in a bizarre spot in terms of the way that it's covered. But also, you know, one shouldn't absolve the Saudis of their mistake, which is not being able to tell their story correctly. For the longest time, it was very difficult to see Saudi officials making the case for Saudi Arabia. Not many people, the country wasn't open for people to visit. Tourists weren't allowed into the country. All of that is changing now. And I think slowly these perceptions of Saudi Arabia might change.
I think that's an important point. I mean, one of the things that I find so interesting, the disconnect between the media and people. So when I travel to the kingdom with people, or when people come back from the kingdom, whether they went for business or pleasure, everybody has a totally different reaction than from what they read in the press. The reaction is much more closely aligned with my experience, which has only grown since 2017. In 2017, I'll admit, I was a little nervous. I showed up, didn't know anything, didn't know anybody. It was a Friday. It was a very, very quiet day. It was just the day in advance before President Trump flew in. But now I can walk around, enjoy it. There's so many cool things to see, some beautiful things. People are very friendly. But I think you're right. I think now that the kingdom has opened up and people can see it for their own eyes, hopefully things will change and more of the truth about today's Saudi Arabia will come out. So speaking of today's Saudi Arabia, you had written an article recently in the last several months in Tablet magazine. The title of the article was "The Politics of Truth in the Middle East, the Young and the Restless." For those of my listeners who didn't read it, I'd encourage them to read it because I think it'll give people a glimpse into today's Saudi Arabia, where the young generation is, where their hearts are, where the crown prince sees them going. Tell me about the article. Why did you write it and how would you sum it up?
Yeah, so the reason I wrote it is because, you know, I had this thought. I was actually on the train going from New York back to Boston. And I was trying to think about, you know, how the Iranian regime and Saudi Arabia fundamentally differ in the way that they approach everything, right? And the thesis for the article is that, you know, in Iran, you've got a geriatric ruling class that is utilizes, empowers, exploits backwards reactionary anti-Western Islamism in order to crush the aspirations of young people in the country that are not necessarily at odds with the West, at least no longer today. Perhaps maybe during the time of the Iranian Revolution, things were different. While in Saudi Arabia, you've got the exact opposite dynamic. You've got a leadership that is drawing on the energy and the aspirations of young people in order to crack down on that very brand of backwards reactionary Islamism that has posed a threat to the Saudi state for a while, especially since the Saudis consider the strategic relationship with the United States and Europe to be central to their national security. So you've got two totally opposite approaches. And the idea is, which one is more aligned with the demographic realities of the Middle East going forward? You know, unlike many European countries, unlike Japan, the Middle East is just like everywhere else in the world. There's a large youth bulge. There's 2/3 of Saudis are under 30 years of age. So the future really belongs to these countries. And the decisions that they make on how to deal with young people, on how to invest in young people, is going to chart out, you know, how history will unfold over the next several dozen decades. So I mean, what I was trying to do is put into perspective, you know, these two differing models. And the idea is, that I don't think the Iranian regime even has the ability to change its course. Its reason d'etre is to fight the United States and fight the West and expand across the region. Any chance that the regime can reform itself is extremely slim. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, that reformation has happened at breakneck speed. And you know, social life in the country that was, you know, severely constricted in the past now doesn't resemble what it was 5 years ago. It's almost like a different country.
So you mentioned Iran. There's so much to talk about in terms of Iran. Why don't we start with what do you think the region, Saudi Arabia in particular, but the region is, think about the Iranian regime and what I would call its threat to the region?
Right. Of course. I mean, the Iranian regime, you know, cultivates almost 100 Shia militias in Iraq that contribute to the destabilization of that country. They're active in Syria. They are the main problem in Lebanon and Yemen. All of these things are you know, concerns for regional actors, you know, including Israel. In the United States, the focus on the nuclear aspect is perhaps understood because the United States isn't in proximity of Iran's proxies. U.S. troops certainly do get targeted by Iranian proxies. That happens, you know, even today. But the region is far away from the minds of the average American, I think. In the region, you know, state failure is a huge threat to the stable states in the Gulf and elsewhere, and state failure is necessary for the Iranian regime to you know, execute its foreign policy. They need a weak state in Iraq, a weak state in Lebanon, a weak state in Syria and in Yemen. That's the model that they use in order to spread across the region. But you know, an important point here is that, you know, while many professors you'll find in American universities might think that the Arab street by and large is fundamentally anti-American or anti-Western, I think that reality has changed fundamentally in the region. While in the 80s and 90s, the idea of being anti-imperialist or, you know, vilifying the United States did find popularity among young people. If you look at those under 30 today, they have a radically different approach to, you know, the way they perceive the West, the way they perceive, you know, Europe and the United States. People are not fundamentally anti-American in many parts of the Middle East like they were in the 80s and the 90s. And you can see this in the way that young Shia Arabs are responding to the Iranian regime. In Lebanon, you know, it was unprecedented that during the protests, so many young Shias called out Hassan Nasrallah by name and Khamenei by name. That's something that was totally off limits only a few years ago. In Babel, in Iraq, they were burning the photos of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the photos of Qasem Soleimani. So, you know, the incompatibility of this, you know, backwards reactionary ideology that is both Sunni and Shia, by the way, Muslim Brotherhood ideology, which is fundamentally anti-imperialist, anti-Western, you know, does intersect a lot with the ideology that underpins the Iranian regime. That ideology is becoming ever more difficult to sell to young people. So time is on the side of the other model, the model that utilizes the energy of young people to crack down on these Islamist forces. Now, what the timeline looks like is a matter of a larger debate, perhaps.
Yeah, and the last part of your answer also reminds me a bit about the earlier question relating to the press, which is people have a hard time looking forward. They spend a lot of time looking backwards, and they fail to understand that we're in a dramatically different forward-looking society throughout the Middle East. The young people really have a promising life ahead of them that's so different than generations past. Just touching on the JCPOA for a minute, I spend a lot of time in the media speaking about how the U.S. should stop negotiating through Europe. We're not even able to negotiate directly, and instead gather together our Middle Eastern allies, who are mostly directly affected, not just by the terror threat, but people also forget the other point there, which you mentioned, which are the proxies that are fomenting terrorism coming from Yemen to attack Saudi Arabia and the UAE, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others. Am I wrong, or do you think that the U.S. should, do you agree that the U.S. should partner with its Middle Eastern allies in dealing with the Iranian threat, the whole threat, not just the nuclear threat?
I mean, I think that makes sense. I think involving, those countries that constitute the foundation of the American security order in the Middle East in such negotiations is important. And that is one of the grievances that America's partners in the region did have and communicated to the Americans about the process of the JCPOA. It's important to note that, the P5 plus one, none of those countries are within the range of Iran's ballistic missiles, not one of them. And all the countries that are U.S. partners in the region that are within range of Iran's ballistic missiles weren't involved in the 2015 JCPOA. And it seems to me that their involvement in these current negotiations is also marginal. Now, it's worth noting that the negotiations have stalled and there seems to be a gridlock. It remains to be seen what will happen. I mean, the anxiety that people have in the region is that if $150 billion is transferred to the Iranian regime and to the IRGC, that will be used in the same way that funds were used in 2015, which is cultivating proxies and prolonging the endless wars that the Iranian regime involves itself in the region. And that's a disaster for people across the region. The idea of containing Iran, of limiting Iran's ability to prosecute its regional expansion is an important one. Many people in the United States measure the efficacy of sanctions solely on their ability to get Iran on the table to sign a deal. Sanctions also serve another purpose. Sanctions also limit, a belligerent actor's ability to navigate and to implement their strategy. The Iranians, at the end of the day, need U.S. dollars in cash in order to pay, these militias that they've cultivated. All, might I add, under the quote-unquote reformist government of Rouhani and Javad Zarif. That's another sort of myth that we hear in Washington, which is that there is reformist people and hardline people in Iran, and that we should side with the reformist people. Ahmadinejad was billed as being a hardliner. But if you want to look at his track record, the regional expansion and the cultivation of proxies and the terror happened much more under Rouhani and Javad Zarif than it did under Ahmadinejad.
So you mentioned Israel in one of your answers, and I want to touch upon Israel. It's a country near and dear to my heart. Not a week goes by where I don't get dozens of questions, when is Saudi Arabia signing the Abraham Accords? And my answer generally is, Saudi Arabia is a much different country than the UAE and Bahrain and even Morocco for lots of reasons. And what I would say is we should applaud Saudi Arabia with every step they take, whether it was the flyover rights that they recently granted, back at the time of the Abraham Accords. And rather than focus on when, we give Saudi the time and the space to do it in their own time. I think personally it's inevitable, but we can't predict when it's going to be. But rather than ask the question of what's the deadline, just watch Saudi Arabia do the many things in Vision 2030, which are incredibly exciting, which their population is so excited about. And slowly but surely, hopefully, Saudi heads in the right direction. How would you answer the question that I keep getting? Would you answer it the same or different?
I mean, Saudi Arabia has been very clear that there has to be a lasting robust peace to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before over the diplomatic relations occur, or at least the process, maybe. Now, as you mentioned, it's important to note that times have changed. I imagine that if you were to walk into a meeting in Riyadh on national security, Israel wouldn't be in the top 10 list of people that people in Riyadh are worried about. And I think the same would apply in Israel, right? I don't think the national security establishment in Israel today is worried about Saudi Arabia. These countries no longer consider each other adversaries. Prince Mohammed has even mentioned in an interview that, you know, there's a lot of benefit, potential benefit that can come from normalization of Israel. But there is a commitment to solving the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. And, you know, if that takes time, then so be it, I guess.
Let's talk about Vision 2030 for the last question. So, you know, I had the privilege of hearing directly from the Crown Prince about the vision over the countless hours when I was in the White House, and it was really breathtaking. You sort of wonder, wow, is this real? Is he going to really do this? Is he going to be able to pull it off? And here we are, 2022, and when I go back to the kingdom and I see some of these projects, I went to see Al-Ula and I went to see Diriyah. I have not been back to Niyam yet, but I spoke to the CEO of Niyam. There's a lot going on, and then people, to me, seem very, very hopeful and excited about this future. What does the average Saudi of your generation feel about these projects in Vision 2030?
I mean, people under 30 in Saudi Arabia, and particularly women under 30, are the biggest supporters of all the changes that are happening under Vision 2030. You know, 110,000 young people have received hospitality training over the past couple of years in Saudi Arabia. And now they're working at hotels, you would see them. They are working in the food and beverage industry. These jobs are new jobs that people are enjoying. If you're a young Saudi woman in Riyadh, you know, overnight, more or less, you now have the freedom to choose your major without going back to your guardian. You have the right to choose your work. You have the right to travel. All of these limitations that existed in the past under the guardianship system have been overturned. So life fundamentally changed for you if you're a Saudi woman. And I think that's one of the reasons that we see such widespread support for all of these reforms that are happening in the country.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because on this recent trip, I noticed many women driving, which of course I didn't see in 2017 on my first trip or even later trips. And women in meetings with the same numbers and power and voice, in whether it was a business meeting, a government meeting. So again, to your point of people misunderstand the region, I really believe they don't understand today's Saudi Arabia and where they're going. What's your message to my listeners about Saudi Arabia? We've covered a lot of topics, but if you had to make one key point to my listeners about today's Saudi Arabia, what would it be?
I would say visit Saudi Arabia. I mean, these changes are real. As a rule, people have had experiences very similar to yours. You know, I'm yet to meet somebody who had a negative view of Saudi Arabia, who visited it, and then came out with an even more negative view of Saudi Arabia. You know, 100% of people that I've met who visited Saudi Arabia sort of had a rude awakening and realized that the country on the ground that they saw is one that is very different from the one that's described by Saudi Arabia's detractors, political or otherwise, in the West.
Mohammed Al-Yahya, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your insight, your life experience, and information about today's Saudi Arabia.
Thank you very much.
Very glad that Mohammed Al-Yahya joined me today. I thought his comments about the press and the media coverage of Saudi Arabia, the backwards-looking coverage, the anti-Saudi coverage versus the forward-looking coverage, and I would argue the honest-looking coverage, was fascinating. It actually does remind me about Israel and the coverage that it gets, as well as a lot of other countries in the Middle East. I think they are misunderstood. Let me know what you think. And do remember, if you're interested in the Middle East, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, or any of the other countries there, the Israeli-Palestinian peace effort, and anything else surrounding the Middle East, please do pick up my new book, In the Path of Abraham. It is out. You can go to Amazon and search Jason Greenblatt or In the Path of Abraham, or go to www.inthepathofabraham.com. Keep listening. Love having you here. And again, I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.